Today is July 25, 1994. This is Lynn Olson. The following is an interview with Professor Aubrey Wendling, who was professor of sociology at San Diego State University from 1954 to 1982. This interview is supported by a mini-grant from the John Adams Humanities Mini-Grant Program, and the interview is being conducted in special collections at the SDSU Library. Okay, let's start at the top. Where and when were you born?
Probably can't remember now. In San Francisco in 1918.
And you grew up in San Francisco?
Pretty much, although we moved around the Bay Area. So my father worked for the railroad company. Seniority, you know, plays a role, or it used to play a role in that, of where you work. But in the main, I graduated from high school in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Went to San Francisco State.
Okay. Where did you get your college degrees then? You went to San Francisco State for your undergrad.
Yeah. Then I went down, well, I went to several places first. I went down to Stanford for a short period of time. And then to Berkeley, and I finally decided I was going to go in sociology. I graduated from San Francisco State with a major in speech and radio.
Hmm.
So that's another story. But and then from Berkeley, I went up to the University of Washington, which was the only really university on the West Coast that had a decent sociology department.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to go up there.
Why did you decide to go into sociology?
I was a speech and radio major. Then I got a little bit interested in speech correction.
Hmm.
And took a number of classes in that, and I became aware that that in order to do that well, you had to really have a strong background in psychology, because there's so emotional kinds of things involved. And so I took some, I went to Berkeley, that's how I, why I went over to Berkeley, and I took some psych classes there, and in that process, I took a social psych class from a very famous person, and then I took a couple sociology classes. From Bob Nisbet and from Robert Merton.
Merton?
Merton. Bob Merton is probably one of the most famous sociologists. He's out of Columbia and was out here for the summer, actually. And then he encouraged me to go on, and at that time I saw that I was really interested in sociology, or that general area of social psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I went to sociology. Historically, when I was an undergraduate, I became close friends with the professor of sociology. And so I think Carlo Astrucci, who I still see this day, as a matter of fact, we just spent a week with him up at their cabin near Mount Lassen. So he was influential also, I think.
Astrucci.
Astrucci, L-A-S-T-R-U-C-C-I.
And so he probably was one of the biggest influences on you to go into sociology, do you think?
Yeah, I think so.
I think.
Plus Bob Merton and Bob Nisbet at the University of California. I think those experiences were exciting. And I think that gave me the kind of push to decide to,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
to do that.
When did you receive your PhD then?
Let's see, in 54.
And that's when you began working at San Diego State.
Yeah.
So you got your degree and immediately came to San Diego State?
Well,
or was there something else
I had no intention of doing that. I had planned to go back to San Francisco State. And Lestrucci had worked it out so that I could come there and my appointment went through the president, went through the department and the division, dean.
Uh-huh.
And the president, at the end, decided to hire a friend from Stanford.
Uh-huh.
So we had already, my wife came down and got a teaching job down the peninsula, and we were all ready to move, and then that happened. So they told me that I could stay as long. I was teaching full-time at the University of Washington at that time, and they told me I could stay there as long as I wished, practically. I suppose there have been some stipulations later on.
Read the fine print in there. It might have said something else. Huh?
And just for kicks, because I was at the end of this whole PhD program, I sent some applications out to I'm not sure where I sent them, but one of them was to San Diego State, or whatever it was called then.
It was San Diego State College.
It was San Diego, yeah. Something like that. So, and I heard nothing from them, so this is about, and I wasn't worried about it because I'd already had a job for the next year and I'd just wait.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden I got a telephone call from San Diego State in August asking me if I was still available to take a job. And the reason they had an opening that Don Walker had moved from the Department of Sociology up to becoming Dean of Men, I guess they called it at that time.
And
so they had an opening, wanted to know if I'd come down. So I had never, all I had was my vita and...
They wanted to know if you would come down for the job or for an interview?
For a job.
For the job. They offered
the
you job, the
job. I was never interviewed. Dean Watson never had the opportunity to interview me.
Amazing, yeah.
I'm not
That's
sure
great.
What he had done.
Why do you say? Why do you say you're not sure what he would have done?
Well, I don't know. He had unusual criteria for hiring people, you know. I remember one time saying he didn't like that guy because he had dirty fingernails.
Wow.
So it was not that I had dirty fingernails. But.
Well, I tell you, nowadays that would make or break the job interview.
Sure would.
You know?
Sure would.
But back.
No, he's a nice guy. But it just I was never interviewed for the job.
So you started teaching that fall.
Yes.
You started teaching the end of August. Huh?
Came down here and they had a Santa Ana and it was awful.
And had you been to San Diego before?
Only once. You know, if you live in Northern California, no one in their right mind goes south of Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the desert down here.
At that. And so I'd only been once when my brother was in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And I came down to visit him. And at that time, you know, we just stayed downtown at the San Diego Hotel, I think it was that time.
So when you moved to San Diego, were you kind of disappointed with the surroundings?
Oh, it was terrible. It was terrible.
Sad
we were up in a motel up on El Cajon, and they had the Santa Ana, and I love foggy weather, and the overcast. I'd lived 7 years in Seattle and got used to that weather, and so they had the Santa Ana, and I came back to the motel and I said, we're leaving. A lot of jobs. I didn't have to worry about getting a job. Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife said, well, look, I've already signed a contract for this next year to teach.
It's she signed a contract down here?
She signed a contract down here.
Where?
With the city schools.
City schools?
Yeah. And she got that right away, incidentally. So the employment market was quite different.
Yeah.
You could, that, that you could get a job any place you wanted to.
So it was her that made you stay, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, I would have left.
You would have left.
Yeah.
You didn't consider maybe having her, or you staying here at the university for a couple of years and then reevaluating your situation and moving on?
Well, I didn't suggest that, but because of her statement, I said, well, we'll stick it out for a year and see what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did.
So that's what you did in the state.
So 100 years later.
Yeah. Any remorse for having done so?
No. I think it's been. I think a rewarding experience. I think there are some qualifications if you'd been in a larger university at that time with the research and so forth that was going on. It would have been a little bit better. But I think sometimes you can do it in spite of the system.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it worked out that way. So, I'm pleased that we did it.
That's good. It's a good university, and it's a beautiful city, too.
Yeah.
Well, when you started here, let's get into some of the visualization then. What was it like when you first arrived on this campus? Where was your office?
No, I remember.
What did you teach?
I remember driving in, and I remember I checked in. I think I had to check in with the president that time, or with somebody. And I drove right up to where the archway is there and parked. I had an office in one of those Quonset huts.
Oh, you had one of those, huh?
Yeah, down on.
Too bad.
Well, where the old library is over there, where the library was.
Yeah, I heard that those were very hot.
It was awful.
It was like an oven in there.
Yeah, 10 or 15 people in the.
All sharing one open space?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, that was.
We just had desks in there, and we all shared open space.
I didn't realize that those Quonset huts were used for that. I thought they were usually used just for teaching.
Yeah.
And then, there were the tea shacks. Did you ever have any classes in a tea shack or tea building?
No, I think most of my classes, the social office was, where the quad is there. The social office was down at the end, underneath someplace, and we generally used those rooms along the side of the quad there.
Okay.
And I think those were the ones that I don't remember being in the tea.
In the tea shacks. Yeah. Did you have fairly good classes? Did you have a decent load? Not too many large classes?
Large classes at that time. I think they're around 30. Something in that neighborhood, 20 to 30, because you remember at that time the population, the enrollment was around 4,000 to 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
So things hadn't really taken quite off yet. And the department itself was, there were only three people in it.
And who were those three people?
Three people, David Milne, I think, was chair, and there was Kenneth Barnhart, and Orrin Clapp. And at the same time that I came, before I ever came, they had hired one other person from the University of Washington, Bernard Kirby.
I don't know the Bernard Kirby name.
Yeah.
Did Orrin Clapp go on to do something else? Was he principal of the...
No, he was here for some time. I think in the 70s or something like that, he took off and went to a Canadian university, I think in London, Ontario.
Okay.
Yes.
So he didn't retire.
And he stayed there for some time. Actually retired from here and then went there and has a retirement.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments about any of these men that you started teaching with here at San Diego State?
I think all three of them were from the University of Chicago.
Huh.
And I think Barnhart was here first, and then he hired Milne, and then they hired Orrin Clapp, all from the University of Chicago.
I've noticed how that works.
Yeah.
To the faculty members in specific departments, they know they have their colleagues out there that they went to school with, and they suggest that those people be hired.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah. And they had a particular orientation about sociology. It was more, it kind of social work oriented.
Uh-huh.
They grew up in that Chicago school that emphasized community studies and concern about crime and delinquency and that sort of thing. So they had quite a different orientation.
And what was your orientation?
Well, I went to the University of Washington primarily. At that period of time, there was a big conflict about whether we could quantify social data.
Uh-huh.
And so mathematics and statistics became more important. Research techniques became important.
Right.
And so at the University of Washington, they hired George Lumberg and Stuart Carter Dodd and a number of other outstanding people that were oriented toward quantitative treatment of this. So I grew up, I graduated in that atmosphere. So I came here with that orientation that I want to do research, and it became crucial.
And you did.
I did.
You did go on to do research. You didn't find any resistance to what you wanted to
no,
do.
No, that's why I stayed, as a matter of fact.
Oh.
Because shortly after I was here, they built that, what we used to call a social science building. And I was given the opportunity to design a whole new research laboratory.
Yeah, it was in 1958, the Social Science Research Center.
Yes.
Did that become the Social Science Research Lab? Is that the
same
thing? Yeah,
they eventually took it away and brought them all together under one.
Took it out of the Department of Sociology.
Yeah.
And you were director
yeah.
for all those 20 years?
Yeah.
Wow, that's quite a long time. So you were the one that pushed to help to establish that research center. Was it? It was not a difficult thing to do.
No.
Did you receive funding from the university?
Yeah.
Outside funding.
Well, you see, when they originally planned the building itself, you have a different kind of opportunity to build something like that into a new building than you have trying to collect money to build it later.
Right.
I guess it comes from a different fund. I don't really understand all that, but I think if you plan it in an initial thing. So I had the opportunity to plan the whole thing as I wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
And then getting the equipment later on that we wanted in there became another problem, but I was treated very well.
Well, you designed the facility as to how you wanted it, but how about staffing? I mean, what did you
how
have
about what?
Staffing for your center? Did you have a regular staff that worked there? Did you
we had a full-time Doug Coe. I don't know if you know
yeah,
Doug.
Yeah, I know that name. Mm-hmm.
I hired Doug Coe, and he was the assistant or the person in charge of the lab. I mean, on a day-to-day basis. And at that time, we did a lot of population studies, and he handled all the cartography. You know, it was pre-computers, really, although we had the only key punch and the only card sorter on campus at that time, yeah.
Wow.
So that was the big boom. It was a challenging thing how you could try to get these things.
So how did you quantify your debt? Well, you had key punch, so.
Yeah.
It must have been very heavily used key punch machine.
Yeah, yeah. We loaned it to other departments. So that... And then eventually, you know, things develop.
So do you think that the Social Science Research Center and your own research then attracted more people to this campus to continue?
It's important.
Yeah, additional research.
What happened after I came and after we started that, the research center, we were hiring a lot of people, maybe three or four people in a given year. So the department began to grow.
Uh-huh.
And the four people that were originally here just kind of gave me a free hand. And so as a consequence, I suppose I did the same thing they did. I brought in a lot of people who were quantitatively oriented and research oriented. But it was different in that we took the point of view that we didn't want somebody to come and necessarily stay here forever. Because the job market was such that you could move around.
Mm-hmm.
So as a consequence, we hired very, very good people for only 3 or 4 years.
Did
and
you
then
have
they
a
would
contract?
Move on.
How did you get them to move on? Did you have
well,
a
they
short-term
wanted to move
contract?
On. See, they didn't have to stay here, and so they just took jobs someplace else.
Uh-huh. But what attracted them to come here for a short period of time were the research facilities available.
Part of that is that as we, I suppose we hired some people on the basis of my knowing them. And then I brought some people in and they knew other people or had contacts. And so when we started adding people who were publishing and people who were doing research, mm-hmm. and that was, you know, that was exciting. And so that subsequently attracted other people to it. So we got some awfully good. We had one of the best departments on the coast for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. It was exciting. It was exciting, and there was all kinds of research going on, and the research center was a focal point for all that. And so
it really grew and grew, didn't it?
Yeah.
It really did. Were you chair of the sociology department ever?
Yeah,
I imagine
a couple of times, yes.
Do you recall any major happenings or goings-on when you were chair?
Yeah, I suppose. The problem, I would say the outstanding problem that we had is that some people that we hired, we felt that was a mistake, and we wanted to get rid of them. And it became very, very difficult to get rid of some of the people. Sometime the department had made a mistake and given a person tenure. I remember one person, they gave tenure, and then immediately after that, they decided that that was a mistake and they would like him to go. So they called him in and said, you know, we prefer you to leave.
They actually said that, huh?
Yeah. And he said,
you
well,
said it was pretty brilliant.
He said, sure, he'd do that. And then he went home and thought about it for a moment, and he came back and said, you know, go to hell.
he had been given tenure. You know, he has a perfect right to say
it. Right.
So what happened? Well,
stayed. Eventually became chairman of the department.
It worked out okay, I hope.
Yeah, it was okay. It was okay. Mm-hmm. But you make mistakes within departments, and I think that was the negative part about being chair, is that some people that you'd like to get rid of had a difficult time doing it, and it became a big hassle in order to do it.
Yeah, I definitely think that is a major problem in any university setting like this. The faculty members frequently are evaluated on their research.
Yeah. And I suppose,
and how well they get along with their colleagues.
That's right.
Teaching may take a back seat. They may not, I'll keep my mouth closed.
I don't know what my image was in the other parts of the campus at that time because I was doing those things, and people just didn't, you didn't can people.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't can people. Just can't do that.
No.
Well, aside from your and the department's image elsewhere on the campus, when it comes to making these decisions about faculty members that should be let go, how about the department's image on campus when it comes to the research that you were doing and the money you were bringing in? I would imagine that you probably had to pursue some grant funding to support some of the projects that you did. Do you think that any of the other departments viewed you differently? Or maybe negatively, or jealous, or wonderful?
Yeah, I think there's a certain amount of animosity because Dale Elliott, who came here also from the University of Washington at a later time, we got the first $1 million grant that ever came to San Diego State, and that was out of the... All these things were housed within the Social Research Center. Mm-hmm. Now, when research is going on, of course you buy up time, teaching time, so that generally, for instance, I only taught half time for a number of years because I was involved in various kinds of research projects. I think there's resentment about that. I think you know, I think sometimes they make a conflict between teaching and research, which is unfortunate.
You taught part-time, but you held a full-time faculty position.
That's
Does that
right.
mean that they couldn't hire somebody else to do your teaching?
Yeah, they hire a person. They have a half-time position to hire somebody.
Wow.
Yeah, that's why they take, and the money's figured right in a project. So when you submit a project proposal,
that's all factored
that's
in.
That's all part of that.
Right, right. What the department is going to have to reimburse to get somebody to teach those classes that you cannot teach, right? Well, which of your research projects that you've listed in this... or that actually Sue Ernest listed in this mortarboard nomination here.
Yeah.
Which of these research projects did you find most interesting for yourself? Most stimulating? Let me give this to you.
Oh, I think that that grant that I just told you about.
The $1 million one?
If that works. I was having a hard time hearing you.
What is that?
Well, it's these electronic things, and you can adjust the hearing aid by pressing.
That's great. Well, I'll speak up also.
Okay. I think the project on school dropouts and delinquency was probably the most interesting one. But it became interesting because of the time that we did that. I think we were working on that in the 60s, if I recall correctly. And it was at that time that within San Diego was the John Birch Society. I don't know if you've ever heard of the John.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Well, our research project involved taking a cohort. Actually, we're taking all the students in a given grade in San Diego, and then survive ninth graders, and then surviving them right through graduation. And we did a lot of things with the parents, and we interviewed them every year and so forth. So it necessitated our going into the classroom and giving a questionnaire to these students. I think we had 3,000 or something like that. The John Birch Society heard, and then rumors started to fly around that we were going to, that we were asking all sorts of personal questions, like sexual behavior, all these rumors. Nothing like that was ever in this. And the school system didn't back us up, and we had a lot of meetings with them. And I even got in touch with the persons persons who headed up the Birch Society, and I asked them to come out and meet with us and go over the questionnaire, because I want you to see what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent, I remember the day, about 3 hours just going over it and saying why we asked this question, what did it mean, and so forth. And when they got through, why one of the ladies said, well, I'd let my daughter take that, there's nothing wrong with that. Then they left, and we were delighted that we had made it.
That's
and
good.
Two, 3 days
Clear
later,
the air.
They were back at it again. And I phoned them up and I said, why are you upset about this? I said, well, you showed us that, and you can't trust sociologists and researchers, and you probably didn't show us the one that you're using. At this point,
can't please everybody all the time, you know.
At this point, why? There were a lot of activities politically. They had our project was turned over to the grand jury, so we had a grand jury investigation.
The project, the eventual outcome of your project.
Well, at this point we were stalemated. We couldn't continue with our project, and we just started. And the school system finally kicked us out. In the meantime, I had tried to protect ourselves in case this happened, and I had contact with people in the Sweetwater School District, And we used that, and they were very cooperative and understanding and understood what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And but we lost our black population that we normally had in San Diego at that time.
Mm.
I had some other contacts up in the Bay Area by Palo Alto, and we eventually used East Palo Alto. I don't know if you've heard about East Palo Alto, but it's a predominantly black community. And so we had two research sites now.
I see. Instead of just one, Center San Diego, you had two.
So we had to travel back and forth from here to San Francisco. So and that went on successfully, and we finally finished it. It was a longitudinal study. It went on for 5 years. So that was an exciting.
And you came to some conclusions about what might cause children to drop out and what might cause children to stay in school?
Yeah.
All the way through?
Yeah. We, you know, we did a lot of publications from it.
National Institute of Mental Health.
Yeah.
1963 to 68. It must have been very frustrating trying to get that thing off the ground. And
yeah,
just
to try to get it started. Terribly frustrating.
I see... let's see, you are obviously environmentally concerned.
Yes.
You have, you've even written a book on mountaineering. I believe I saw your book in the library's computer catalog.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. I checked the pack to make sure that we...
Yeah, actually I did that with Henry Mandolf.
Uh-huh.
And... he came up with things you wanted to include, and then I wrote the
You
book.
Wrote the text?
Yeah. Living in, when I first went to Seattle, I was upset by the weather, and I complained about it, and someone suggested that if I didn't like it, why didn't I go back to San Francisco? And so Lucille, my wife, and I decided to see what all this outdoor business was about. Because I was a city boy. You know, I learned how to
survive
ride on the bumpers of streetcars and stuff like that, you know. And so we went out and we did some backpacking. And it was a very humorous thing because we didn't have the equipment or anything like that. We eventually got interested in the mountaineers,
mm-hmm.
and took up their basic mountaineering course and eventually climbed most of the major peaks in the United States. We learned snow and ice by
Lucille, too.
Yeah.
She didn't let you go along with you on all those climbs.
Yeah, right.
That's great.
We did.
That's
so that was fun stuff. And I was in charge of the lectures of the mountaineering course eventually. And so when I came down here, I had all that material, and that was the basis for the basic mountaineering book.
Oh, so you already had it all written already, huh?
Practically.
That's great.
Yeah.
And you also served as two terms as president of the San Diego chapter of the Sierra Club. I'm not going to get into too much of this stuff because it's not directly related to SDSU.
Yeah, that's true.
Are you still involved in the Sierra Club?
No.
No, no longer, huh? Did you ever take any environmental issues here at San Diego State? I'm thinking about how, you know, there was so much open space around here, and now there is none.
Yeah.
And I have talked to other faculty members, retired faculty members, who wish that some space had been set aside. Did you ever think of that?
No, it had never become an issue. I suppose we didn't see how much it was going to grow and what was going to happen, I
mm-hmm.
think. I think it was a mistake. But I don't even, people who have been real active environmentally, Phil Pride in geography and some of the other people who are...
I don't know if he would have been around long enough to
Even Jim Crouch, you know, was involved with the Audubon Society for years.
Yeah.
And,
but I never asked them the question about how he felt about preserving any of the space around here at San Diego State. I think by the time Pride came on board, Adobe Falls was no more.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is really too bad.
Yeah.
Well, I think I'll skip over that one a little bit.
Now, let's get back a little bit to the department and university administration. When you came here in 1954, President Love.
Yes,
I just around.
Yeah, he'd just been here a year or two.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of President Love and the administration?
Of President Love, I have really good relationships with. I think he was a great president. I think he's the best president they've ever had. And he was the type of person that could say he was wrong and apologize for it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is unusual. And the other person that was really important at that time was Dean Watson, of course, who was Dean of Instruction, I guess.
Yeah. I always got Watson and Walker mixed up.
I remember the first year I was here, I had done my PhD dissertation was on suicide in the San Francisco Bay Area. And they were holding the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Berkeley that year. So I had come here in the fall, and my paper had been selected for distribution to the media. And so I had to turn in 50 copies. And I remember I went over to some place, so they had a mimeograph center, I think, at that time. And I went over there and I said, I'd like 50 copies of this, which you're used to doing at a university.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, that would be impossible. They said, is it instructionally related? And I said, well, I don't think so. It's been selected for this. I think it's important. And they said, well, no, we can't do that. So I went to Dean Watson and I said, look, I'd like to get this 50 copies of this, and they wouldn't do it. Can you do it? No, it's true. I'd only been here 6 months, and he'd known me from Adam. But he said that he's sorry, couldn't help out. So I remember going up. There was a place up on El Cajon Boulevard, and paying for it myself and getting the 50 copies. Well, so they were distributed to the news media in San Francisco, and we came out of the meeting when I gave the paper. It had made the headlines of the San Francisco News, or
wow,
the Call Bulletin, or the Chronicle, or whatever one.
Wow.
And there happened to be a couple of people from San Diego State that I didn't know at those meetings. I guess somebody from physical. When I came back, Watson called me in and apologized for not doing it. And I could...
Understanding what
he
needed.
I could mimeograph anything I damn well pleased. So those were funny experiences. I can understand. You see, that's kind of what happened when I came in 54. There was this small cohesive group of professors and social groups.
Mm-hmm.
They had a number of them had gone to. They had known one another for many, many years. They went to high school together. And they got teaching credentials and were teaching in the public schools, and then they would hire here as professors, you see, without PhDs. Some of them didn't even have MAs. They eventually got an MA.
Mm-hmm.
So that there was that cohesive kind of group that was here. So, and there was no pretense or no effort to bring any of the new people into that group at all. So, but the school grew fast enough so that we formed our own group and had our own parties and that sort of thing.
You mean the new faculty members did?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that there was kind of a split between the old school and the new school.
Oh, yeah.
Pre-50s and then 50s onward, huh?
Hmm. Yeah. In fact, Lucille and I used to... I would think every other weekend we'd go up to Los Angeles. And that was quite a drive in those days, you know.
Yeah.
Because there were the people that we knew. And I'd been active in professional associations, so I knew a lot of people around. And we knew people there, and we'd stay up the weekend. These were people we could talk to.
Why up in L.A.? I don't understand why L.A.
Well, because there's UCLA, and there were people I just knew. But there are no schools here. And there was nobody in sociology.
That you knew, and knew as a friend.
Yeah, well, within the department, there wasn't mm-hmm. any.
Uh-huh.
You know, I had, outside of friendship kind of things with the people there.
Well, obviously things have changed a little bit for you now because of this retirement association. You were instrumental in getting that going, so you have a different feeling about those people now. That's my impression.
Well, an interesting thing happened.
Good friends?
Very, very good friends, a lot of these people who were here then. I didn't know them. I didn't know them actually until after I'd retired. Now, they used to be in, we used to have faculty meetings in which everybody went to the faculty meeting, everybody. But I just...
But it was not easy to socialize with these people.
No.
You just didn't.
We were pretty well excluded from it.
Yeah. Well, you were possibly separated into your own office area, your own department.
I remember we were having, a lot of interdepartmental things, particularly with psychology and history and that sort of thing. And we'd have the cocktail parties and that sort of thing, but none of the old guard
would show.
Well, I'm sure they probably weren't invited.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
That's really too bad. That's not a good way to create goodwill department members. You should include everybody, it seems.
So I think as you talk to other people, they'd say, well, I didn't really know Aubrey until retirement.
Well, since I mentioned the Retirement Association, let me ask you about that. Now, you, whose idea was it to start the Retirement Association? And can you tell me how it went?
How it started, I have to give you a little history from the University of Washington. They had, years ago, an awful time up there. They had situations in which the retired professors weren't getting any money. Some of the widows were on welfare. It was an awful situation. A very good friend of mine, who was a faculty member there, decided to do something about it and changed the whole retirement system up at the University of Washington. In the process of doing that, they established a retirement association. So I had a lot of contact and understanding of what took place there. It was a faculty staff kind of a retirement association.
As opposed to just faculty only.
Yes.
So
when I mentioned this down here, and then about that same time, Sue Ernest, who was involved with the statewide association, called a bunch of people together and said, what do you think about having a retirement association of faculty people? And she went on to elaborate about what it should be. And we thought it was a good idea. And at that point, they asked me if I would do that. Of course, I was already ready to do it in the first place. So,
a little more extensively, though.
Yeah.
Not just faculty. It sounds like Sue Ernest had the idea that it should be faculty.
She was vehement about it.
She was.
Yeah, and caused a lot of problems arguing that it should be only faculty and we should have sit around having great thoughts and all this kind of thing. But I brought a group of people together. We met for a whole year. Just discussing, drawing up the bylaws and,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. And that was one of the issues. That was one of the big issues.
Personal services had to be drawn into this as well.
Big part?
Personal services had to be drawn into this to figuring out what the Retirement Association could do. I mean, we're not talking just about a social group. We're talking about something that's going to benefit the retirees.
Yes.
And, of course, the people from personal services are not necessarily faculty members. I'm thinking of Norma Summerskill.
Yes, right.
Wasn't she instrumental in the
Retirement
Association?
She's one of the first ones, and she was on that original committee. So when we when I formed that committee, I was very careful to balance it between staff people and faculty people. And that's when it got a little embarrassing a couple of times when Sue Ernest was so vehement and outspoken about how we shouldn't have any staff people. Mm. In it. Mm. And some of the people, one of the persons got mad and was offended by it and got off the committee because of that. Mm. But people have opinions like that. And to Sue's credit, she's one of the persons who is the most enthusiastic about having a faculty staff.
Yeah, that's what I figured from through this document here.
Yeah.
The way she wrote it, it sounds like it, you know, she loves it. It's a great idea. Well, now, there are a number of active members in that retirement association. Most of them are faculty, however, are they not? I don't see very many active, or don't hear of very many active staff.
Well, Grant Nielsen.
Oh, that's true. Excuse me. Aside from Grant Nielsen.
Yeah, I think Viva Link has been active, and a bunch of people I'm trying to think of. I think it's kind of a balance. It's a balance on the board.
Is it?
Yeah.
I guess I'm scanning through the directory. I see a lot of faculty names, not very many staff. I don't mean to harp on the staff thing. It's just a fluttering thought.
Yeah, I think I've counted them all.
Yeah.
And there are more faculty than there are staff.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things do you do?
What
kind of activities do you do in the Retirement Association?
There's just a wide range of things from social activities. Over the months, what's today? I guess on Saturday, we went up to the Laguna Art Festival.
Oh, you did?
I hadn't been up there for 10 years, and that was fun to do that again. So a lot of activities of that nature, a wide range of things. I think the thing that I feel stronger about is some of the other things that we've done with the mortar board, that thing we were involved in that award. We were involved in having an emeritus faculty member give a speech once a year with most important of all, my little baby is the scholarships. And this year we actually gave $3,000 scholarships.
That's wonderful.
So that's kind of exciting, and that's growing up. Hopefully we get enough money to have that self-perpetuate.
That's great. And now these scholarships are supported by endowments?
Yeah, with people who have donated, and We've had projects, you know. We've sold Entertainment 90 books, and whatever proceeds we got from that went into it. And sometimes we'll in having trips and activities, there'll be a surplus from there, and we'll put it in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hope we can get somebody to give us a lot of money sometime.
Yeah, you need a benefactor, huh? To give you lots and lots of money.
Yeah.
And then you put it away in an endowment account and live off the interest. That's the way to go.
Right. That's what we're trying to do.